From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, day-to-day life in Israel and the West Bank and recent developments in the Middle East, we talk with Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh, author of the new memoir, When the Birds Stopped Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. Shahadeh is a lawyer and a founder of the human rights organization Al-Haq. And we talk with David Horovitz, editor of the Israeli news magazine The Jerusalem Report, and author of the forthcoming book Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's season premiere of 24. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The wildfires in Southern California have now claimed at least 15 lives and destroyed more than 1,500 homes. California Governor Gray Davis says the cost of the damage is estimated at nearly $2 billion. A break in the weather is helping firefighters in at least one of the 10 separate blazes that are scorching the region. NPR's Kerry Kahn reports from Los Angeles.
Firefighters in Simi Valley west of Los Angeles were able to battle back the fire before dawn this morning, saving hundreds of homes. Increased humidity and cooler temperatures helped the crews. In San Bernardino and San Diego counties, the picture isn't as good. 20 buildings, possibly including several homes, burned in the San Bernardino National Forest. The fire jumped a major road and is threatening the resort community of Lake Arrowhead. In San Diego County, hundreds of residents from the mountain community of Julian and Descanso, east of the city, have been evacuated. Schools throughout San Diego County remain closed for a second day. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Los Angeles.
President Bush defended his administration's policies in Iraq today at a surprise news conference. One day after the deadly car bombings in Baghdad, the president said the attacks were the work of foreign terrorists and supporters of Saddam Hussein. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
President Bush appeared to bristle at reporters' questions about whether the administration had leveled with the American people on the difficulties U.S. troops would face in Iraq. The president said he's always admitted there would be challenges.
I can't put it any more plainly. Iraq's a dangerous place. That's leveling. It is a dangerous place. What I was saying is there's more than just terrorist attacks that are taking place in Iraq. There's schools opening. There are hospitals opening.
He said certain people, though, don't want to see such changes. He said the U.S. is trying to determine who's behind the attacks, but that he assumes it's the work of foreign terrorists and Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist supporters. He said the United States is working with Syria and Iran to secure Iraq's borders. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Democratic Leader Tom Daschle said today that he questions the president's analysis of the progress in Iraq.
I was very troubled by the president's statement about what it means. If this is progress, I don't know how much more progress we can take. I would also say that there is a growing credibility gap between what is said and what is being done.
Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota. Iraqi police say a car bomb killed at least four people outside a power station in Fallujah, about 40 miles west of Baghdad. The explosion took place near a school and a police station, so the actual target was unclear. Fallujah's been a focus for opposition to the U.S.-led occupation. In stocks today, the Dow gained 140 points, nearly 1.5%, to close at 9,748 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve has decided to leave a key short-term interest rate unchanged. The Fed's monetary policymakers said they decided to keep the federal funds rate at 1%, the lowest it's been in more than 40 years. The decision means that most commercial banks will probably keep their prime lending rates at 4% and that other loan rates will remain low. In a statement after today's meeting, the Fed said the U.S. labor market appears to be stabilizing. That's an improvement from last month when the Fed said that labor markets appeared to be getting weaker. At the trial of sniper murder suspect John Muhammad, jurors in Virginia heard testimony today about several shootings in a single day last year. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Get out of here, get out of here, there's a sniper on the loose. That warning was given by a Washington, D.C. police officer responding to the shooting of 72-year-old Pascal Charlot the night of October 3rd. He was the fifth person gunned down that day, who prosecutors say was a victim of Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo. Prosecutors have been questioning witnesses from the day's shootings. Two people say they saw an older blue Chevrolet Caprice near shooting scenes. A medical examiner has testified the deaths were caused by high-velocity bullets. The witnesses painted a picture of chaos and fear in the Washington area October 3rd as it became clear people were being targeted at random. One paramedic testified police showed up wearing riot gear at one shooting. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ gained 49 points, or more than 2.6%, to close at 1,932. The S&P 500 gained 15 points, 1.5%, to close at 1,046. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fairfield Farm Kitchens, creator of Organic Classics handcrafted frozen chicken entrees and toaster muffins, available in supermarkets and natural food stores nationwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to look at the Middle East. A little later, we'll speak with David Horovitz, the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. First, we're going to hear from Raja Shahadeh. He's written a new memoir based on the journal he kept when his town Ramallah was occupied by the Israeli army from late March to late April of 2002. This was part of a larger Israeli military operation to root out terrorists in response to suicide bombings. Shahadeh's new book is called When the Birds Stopped Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. His previous memoir was about growing up in the West Bank. Shahadeh is a Palestinian lawyer who co-founded the human rights organization Al-Haq. In 1991, he was a legal advisor to the Palestinians at the Middle East Peace Conference. He's been out of public life for the past 9 years, concentrating on his legal practice and his writing.
Your new book, When the Birds Stop Singing, is about life in Ramallah starting in the spring of 2002, when the Israelis occupied Ramallah. Are there liberties that you feel you still don't have that you lost during that occupation?
Oh, absolutely. All aspects of my life has been made more difficult. Movement in and out of Ramallah is hazardous and with long delays. And the possibility for leaving Ramallah and just visiting family or going to the university or going to work in Jerusalem or in Bethlehem or in Nablus, as my work requires me to do, has become extremely difficult, very time-consuming. So, and at the same time, the fear of living in a place where you are literally at the whim of the soldiers who can come in at any time, blow a house, arrest people, throw a missile at a car where you might just as well be standing and therefore lose your life, or people who know lose their life. All of these things make it very difficult to live in the occupied territories. It makes it feel that it's a question of time before our life will be completely destroyed.
I'm wondering what your opinion is of a peace plan that was drawn up by a group of prominent Palestinian and Israelis working in an unofficial capacity. So this is an unofficial peace plan, but I think the idea is it can be a prototype for an official peace plan. The idea was, let's prove that we can reach some kind of compromise and then move on from there. This is a model for one way of dividing up the land, forming a Palestinian state, and dealing with the contested mosque in East Jerusalem and the Western Wall. Does this peace plan have your confidence?
I've read the plan, and there are some details that I'm not so happy with and some details which need to be there that are missing. But I think it's an extremely important step. I think it proves that there is a possibility for arriving at peace. I think it reflects what the majority of Palestinians and Israelis want, which is peace based on a territorial compromise, on a division of the land between the two people. And I think it makes it clear that the Israeli government, which is saying there's no possibility for peace through compromise, is not telling the truth. So it's a very important political statement, and I hope it will have the impact and the support of the United States and other countries in the world.
One of the parts of this peace plan that I imagine is controversial among a lot of Palestinians is how it deals with the right of return.
It says that any Palestinian can move to the new Palestinian state, but they would not have the right of return to Israel. How does that play with you?
Well, I am of the position that this question of the right of return is often used, especially by Israelis, to indicate that as long as the Palestinians call for the right of return, they are not really serious about peace with Israel. What they really are after is destroying Israel. Now, I am a person who stands for a two-state solution, who is comfortable with the continued existence of Israel side by side along Palestinian state in the occupied territories, including Jerusalem. And at the same time, I believe that the right of return is a right that must not be given up so easily. It doesn't mean that the right of return means the actual physical return of every Palestinian to where they were in 1948, because that is well nigh impossible. But the right of return must be recognized. No one speaks about the right of return in the absence of the recognition of Israel. So once a Palestinian state recognizes an Israeli state and vice versa, then the sovereignty of the Israeli state is also recognized. And therefore, any return of any number of people is going to be under the terms and under the laws of Israel. And therefore, the possibility of destroying Israel by the return is not on. So this is one thing. The other thing, everybody knows that the largest number of the Palestinian villages that were in existence in 1948 have been destroyed, utterly destroyed. So the possibility of actual return is not on. So I'm thinking that, first of all, the Palestinians need that recognition that they were harmed, that something very terrible was done to them by Israel. No peace can come without that recognition. And then I think a formula must be found for the majority to return to the Palestinian areas, of course, and some, I don't know what numbers, I don't know what proportion, return to Israel as a symbolic action, which Israel is comfortable with. In the negotiations in Camp David, they were comfortable with this. And then, of course, compensation would have to be paid as well.
It sounds like you're saying, although you're glad that this new unofficial peace plan exists, you couldn't really back it because it doesn't have any right of return.
No, I can back it because I think they have very important aspects of what I think needs to be there as elements for the peace. And I don't think the right of return is one issue that should spoil any peace agreement, because I don't think that there is such adamant determination by the Palestinians to insist on full return. And it's certainly not my position. So I'm very close to what is in that document. But I think this is only an initial document. And of course, there needs to be more details fleshed out, and perhaps the question of the right of return and what sort of compensation and what sort of numbers we're talking about needs to be fleshed out. But the principles that are in that document are the principles that I agree to as the basis for the peace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Raja Shahadeh. He is a Palestinian human rights lawyer who has also participated in some of the earlier Middle East peace talks. He has a new memoir called When the Birds Stopped Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. The suicide bombings have really escalated in the past couple of years. Do you know anybody who is directly connected with that? In other words, how close have you come to witnessing somebody who has been convinced that they should blow themselves up in order to blow up the people they perceive as their enemy?
I don't know directly, but of course, several of the people, but in the last period, two were lawyers. One was a 29-year-old woman lawyer who ended up blowing herself. And of course, I heard of her story. And when you hear of the story, what happened before she took the decision, you can begin to understand. Her brother and her cousin were killed in front of her. Their bodies were dragged. I mean, horrific tales. But it's always my point is not to compete in the horror and in the tragedy, because both sides have their share of the horrors. And the point is not to compete who suffered more. But I know victims of these operations, Israelis and Palestinians. And very often when I experience some of the things that some of these people experience, maybe not as severe, I can understand why they are driven to this. But at the same time, one of the horrors of life in the occupied territories is to be surrounded by such despair that makes people ready and willing to give up their life in this manner and arbitrarily destroy in the process civilians. You know, the fact that the Israelis are killing children and civilians, to my mind, does not justify the Palestinians doing likewise to the Israelis. So it's not easy to live in a society where all around you are potential people who would carry out actions of this sort. You constantly wonder, what is wrong with us? How did we get to this point? How can we start getting back from that edge? We are really at the edge. We are at the 11th hour, and it's very important for all of us to be responsible.
Do you feel that you have witnessed extremist groups manipulating the despair to try to create an environment where people are willing to blow themselves up?
Well, I'm sure, you know, I've lived all my life in Ramallah, and there was no possibility that anybody would do something like this before 1994. The first such operation was in 1994, and it was after this Israeli settler in Hebron killed worshippers. Before that, it was inconceivable that something like this would happen. Now, of course, it's partly due to the events and the practices of the Israelis, but it's also partly true to religious fundamentalism that is much more apparent now than ever before. So there is manipulation. At the end of the invasion, the Israeli army entered my house, and I had been worried from the very beginning. And what I found were young people who I'm sure were easy to manipulate. This is speaking now on the Israeli side, who were unable to look me in the eye. I couldn't have any impact on them. I couldn't begin to speak to them. So yes, there is manipulation at a certain point by the Palestinians of young people and by the Israelis of their young people.
Tell us more about what happened when the Israeli army came to your house.
Well, I had been worried all throughout of exactly this. And, you know, the worry is not only because of what physical damage they would do. It's also a question of, would I be able to stand it? Will I break down? Will I be able to do the right thing? There's always self-doubt as well. So it was early in the morning. I had just woken up. I hadn't taken my shower. And the telephone rings. And then a neighbor says, the army are on their way to your house. They've just finished with the next door house. Be ready. And that was great, because otherwise I wouldn't have been ready. So I rushed, put on my clothes. I didn't want to face them with my pajamas. Put on my clothes and tried to psychologically put myself in the right frame of mind. They rang the bell. Fortunately, I have a gate, and so they cannot bang on the door, and I hate people banging on the door. So they rang the bell, they entered, and I found myself confronted by these young people who were dressed in this huge gear which almost insulated them from everything around them. They looked at me, they looked at the house, and they were taken aback because they found an ordinary civilian house. I'm not a big person, so again, maybe that disarmed them. And I wasn't angry or hateful, because I was ready for them. I just looked at them and said, what do you want? And they started searching. They said they wanted to look around. And my wife took some of them to one side of the house. I took the others to the other side of the house. And they went around. And I tried to make some contact with them, you know, human contact. But it wasn't possible. It wasn't possible at all. So I felt some pity for people who are put in that situation, who I don't know what they're told about us, that every Palestinian hates them, and they live with this burden.
My guest is Raja Shahadeh. His new memoir is called When the Birds Stop Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Raja Shahadeh. He's a lawyer and writer and a founder of the human rights organization Al-Haq. His new book, When the Birds Stop Singing, is a memoir about life in Ramallah in the spring of 2002, when it was occupied by the Israeli army in response to suicide bombings. One of the things underway now is a barrier fence that has the goal of just physically separating the Palestinians from the Israelis on the border of the West Bank, but also protecting the settlements within that area. How do you think that barrier fence might affect your life in a direct way?
Very much so. The barrier fence, well, it's not really a fence. It's a wall. It's an apartheid wall because it's not going along the borders. It's going into inside the occupied territories and etching a new border. It's going to affect my life because once the part around Ramallah is completed, then I will be surrounded by huge walls, and exit and entry will depend on the whim of the soldier if he decides to open the gate for me. It's very strange that after all what has been happening in the world, I was just in Berlin for my book and saw how the wall there was is a thing of the past. Israel is still thinking of walls and encampment and ways that have proven useless as a possible protection and security. And of course what it's aimed at is creating a new border and an unfair border that will include the settlements.
You are of Christian background, and yeah. I'm wondering, a lot of the most militant and extreme opposition to Israelis comes from Islamic militias. Are you concerned that if those militias become the main voice of the Palestinian people, that when there is a Palestinian state, it will be an Islamic state, and that, you know, your identity as a Christian or your rights as a Christian might be compromised in some way?
The beauty of Palestine historically has been a place of tolerance between the three religions, by the way, because Christians, Jews, and Muslims were living side by side. If it ever comes to the point when it's going to be a purist state, only Jewish on one side, only Muslim on the other, and with total intolerance, then there would be no place for me to live. So my struggle is a struggle for attaining freedom and for the right values. And the right values are values of tolerance.
Do you feel that that's a dialogue that's actually going on yet within Palestinian society? The dialogue about what the future of a Palestinian state would be, and would it be an Islamic state? And if it was, what would that mean?
Yes, there is a dialogue going on, and it's taking the form of the constitution. The proposed constitution has been under discussion for years now, and the question of the personal status law, whether it's going to be that the religious law is the source of all the laws or one of the sources, has been a question that is under great discussion.
A lot of division among Palestinian people about this?
Well, the extremists argue that it should only be religious, and the others are saying that we cannot allow it to be such as, you know, a religious law. And at this point, compromises are still possible, but the more we go on with the present situation of feeling threatened as a society, the more the extremists win the day. That's the point, you know. That's why it's very important to find a solution before it's too late. That is why I also think that if the United States were a true friend of Israel, it would help Israel make the necessary compromises, because ultimately the way things are going in the Palestine and in the region is not good for Israel. I mean, Israel will have a better life in a region that has more tolerance and toleration, and that's not happening as long as Israel is pursuing the policies that it's pursuing.
Anger in the Arab world at Israel and at the United States, particularly after September 11th, seems to have opened the door to a more volatile expression of anti-Semitism. One example would be the Prime Minister of Malaysia, who recently said, "The Jews control the world." I wonder how this new expression of anti-Semitism looks from your perspective, if it's of any concern to you. And I know your main concern is the rights of Palestinian people, but nevertheless, I'm sure you have an opinion about this.
It's of great concern to me. I do not believe that any attempt by making it seem that it's one great conspiracy by the Jews of the world or by the Muslims of the world is good for my cause. Such statements are very destructive. Also, the implication that they have or the false hope or belief that they might give to anybody on my side, in my country, that, look, the whole of the Muslim world is behind us, all of them fighting the Jews of the world. It doesn't work like that. This is not the basis on which the problem rests. I mean, I don't see it as Jew against Muslim. It's a national struggle between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. And it should be confined to that. It doesn't help us to have people in Malaysia say the world is controlled by the Jews. I mean, that's a conspiratorial theory that has always been harmful to our cause.
Roger Shahadeh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Roger Shahadeh is the author of the new memoir, When the Birds Stop Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. We spoke yesterday during his brief visit to the U.S. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osman's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with David Horovitz, editor of the Israeli news magazine The Jerusalem Report, and author of the forthcoming book Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror. And David Bianculli previews tonight's season premiere of 24. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, we heard from Palestinian lawyer and writer Raja Shahadeh. My next guest, David Horovitz, is the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He also writes a column for the magazine. Horovitz has lived in Israel since emigrating from England in 1983. He's the author of the book A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel. His next book, Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror, will be published in March. We recorded our interview this morning. He spoke from a studio in Jerusalem. He told me that in Israel, fear of suicide bombings is profound and unrelenting. I asked him if there are places where Israelis feel most safe or most vulnerable.
Well, that's the awfulness. There is nowhere in Israel that is off limits to terrorism. I've been to funerals where there are security guards. Hospitals now, in the wake of a suicide bombing, have to upgrade their own security because of the concern that somebody may seek to profit from the chaos and blow up the hospitals. For me, the key proof that there was nowhere left that was a haven was the bombing a little over a year ago at the Hebrew University campus on Mount Scopus, which for which I have a true fond connection because it happens to be where I met my wife. There was always an assumption that nobody would blow up Hebrew U because there are thousands of Arabs on the campus. And then last July, somebody blew it up. We become almost domestic security analysts. My wife and I have had very earnest and not particularly emotional conversations about things as banal as where to do the shopping. You know, which is safer this week? Should we go to the grocery store on the corner where there's no security guard, but it's unlikely that it would be targeted because there are not that many people there at any one time? But of course, things like that have been targeted. Should we go to the supermarket where there is a guard? But of course, the guard, if he does his job, may not be able to prevent the bombing. He may just be killed by the bomber, and that's happened, and it's happened in Jerusalem. Or in our case, we can go to Malha, which is this great big shopping mall in southern Jerusalem, where security is like, it's like airport security. You know, I'm fairly blonde, but I'm the least blonde member of my family, and we all look like sort of recent arrivals from Sweden. And yet when we pull up at Malha, we'll still get the third degree, and they'll check the trunk of the car, and, you know, all the things that I've forgotten to take out that are inexplicable and bizarre get sort of raked over. And that's just to get into the parking lot. And then you get to the entrance to the mall itself, and it's, you know, it's a metal detector gate and a guard with a detector stick, you know, to make sure you haven't got explosives under your clothes. And therefore, when you get into Malha, you think, you know, you sort of heave this sigh of relief and think, okay, here I'll be safe. But of course, because it's closed in and because it's crowded, if a bomber did get into Malha, the devastation would be all the more atrocious. And you really do. You have quite calm conversations about, well, okay, where is it better to buy our cornflakes and milk this week? Where is the least likely place to get blown up?
Have the suicide bombers affected your overall feelings about the Palestinian people? Or do you feel like you can contain your anger at the suicide bombers to the bombers themselves?
Well, I can only relate to the Palestinian people by the criteria that opinion polls and surveys provide for me. So I would love to be able to say that, you know, of course I recognize that it's only a small minority of Palestinians who are carrying out suicide bombings, which is, of course, the case, only a small minority. I mean, 100-plus, quote-unquote, successful bombings in 3 years is a fairly devastating minority, but it's a minority. And yet, troublingly, of course, survey after survey after survey shows that most Palestinians are saying they support the suicide bombers. So that, of course, has to filter into my conception of the Palestinian people. At the same time, I'm very aware that, in my opinion, this is a nation, a people who have been horrifically misled by their leadership. I mean, this is a leadership that came back from a very serious effort by an Israeli government 3 years ago to make peace and told its people, the Palestinian leadership told its people, that the Israelis didn't want to make peace. In other words, to my understanding of how things panned out here, the leaders lied to their people, told them that the Israelis never wanted to partner them towards independence, never were prepared to relinquish territory, never wanted viable terms for peace, all of which I think is a gross and malicious misportrayal of what happened at Camp David. And then on top of that, I know too, they have endured 3 years of hell. You know, as we've tried to stop the bombers, well, we've stopped them working inside Israel, and we've put up roadblocks and curfews and closures and all the things that we've done to try and keep ourselves safe, and that has affected ordinary people. So I understand, you know, I think there is a fair amount of hostility to Israel. I think it's manipulated hostility. I think it's hostility that could have been avoided, and I know that 3 years ago it wasn't there.
The Sharon government's policy toward Arafat right now is a policy of removal. Sharon has said the policy is not for assassination, it's for removal. What exactly does that mean in your understanding?
Well, first of all, I don't know. And I don't know because the Israeli government doesn't want me to understand, and quite possibly because they don't know what they're planning to do either. You're right that as of a few weeks ago, there was a Sharon was on an official visit to India, and there were two suicide bombings within just a few hours of each other, one of them not far from where I live in Jerusalem, and one in Ramleh, not far from Tel Aviv. Sharon dashed back from this official trip and passed a resolution in the cabinet that said Israel has decided to remove Yasser Arafat as somebody who's an obstacle to peace and somebody who incites terrorism, but will do so at a moment of our choosing. Well, since then, there have been subsequent bombings, and the Israeli right is asking the Prime Minister, why has Arafat not been removed? And the Israeli left is asking the Prime Minister, why did Israel attract all this international opprobrium and render Arafat very popular again among ordinary Palestinians, and then actually not do anything anyway? So we're all kind of baffled and mystified. Just the other day, Sharon said Israel's not going to kill Arafat, when one of his deputies had indicated that that was certainly one of the possibilities. I don't know what the government wants to do with Arafat. I know that I think most Israelis would like Yasser Arafat to fall down dead as soon as possible of natural causes without an Israeli anywhere within range, so that we won't be blamed for it. You know, one wants to wish people long life. But I don't think one feels that one wants to convey those wishes to somebody who has plainly been encouraging the murder of civilians. Arafat's a problem. Removing Arafat in any kind of dramatic way by Israel would I think the assessment is, be very counterproductive. It would unleash violence. It would discredit any potentially moderate successor. None of the options for handling Arafat are good, and that, I think, is why the Israeli government still doesn't quite know what to do about him.
The Sharon government is in the process of building a barrier that is supposed to basically wall out Palestinians from Israel so that there isn't a permeable area in which potential suicide bombers could cross over. One of the controversial things about this barrier is that it doesn't adhere to the border of the West Bank in Israel. It is twisting around Israeli settlements within the West Bank to protect the settlers. The development is despised among Palestinians in the West Bank. Is it controversial in Israel?
It's not hugely controversial in principle. There is a wide support in Israel for anything that makes it harder for suicide bombers to get into Israel. And just, you know, to emphasize the tiny distances that we're talking about here, I drove very recently along what's called Road 6, which is a new road that extends along the eastern spine of Israel. And it runs all the way up to next to Tulkarem. Tulkarem is a West Bank Palestinian city, right on the Israel-West Bank border. And I then drove east to west across the whole width of Israel to Netanya, which is a coastal city. And the drive, in other words, from Israel's eastern sovereign border to Israel's western sovereign border, is it's minutes. It took me 11 minutes to get from Tulkarem to the entrance to Netanya. And until this barrier started going up, that meant it was, you know, a 10-minute, 15-minute drive down the road for a bomber from Tulkarem to get to Netanya, as tragically several bombers did. So there's a huge amount of support, understandably, in that context, I think, for anything that makes life harder for the bombers to enter Israel. But there's also big disagreement within Israel about how this barrier should extend. And even though it's being built, some of the route has not been finalized, and the arguments are continuing. It seems to me that the further east it runs, in other words, where it enters Palestinian territory, it becomes counterproductive, because you will then have, by definition, Palestinians on the supposedly safe side of your fence. So you're undermining the whole security imperative.
The whole idea of a wall is... you know, walls through history have a lot of really negative connotations, including the Warsaw Ghetto, East Berlin. What's some of the moral complexity of knowing that your government, your country, is, you know, responsible for erecting a wall?
Well, you see, first of all, I don't think that my government is responsible for erecting a wall. I think suicide bombers are responsible for my government erecting a wall. And again, you just need to look at very recent history. There was no big security barrier between Israel and the West Bank. There was no desire whatsoever on the part of the Sharon government to build any such barrier. By the way, I think barrier is a better term than wall. It is indeed a wall in some places where Palestinian residential areas come right up against the edge of sovereign Israel. In most places, it's a fence with patrol roads and so on. not wildly different to some borders in between countries in particularly tense areas. But none of this would have been going up if the bombers weren't coming to get us. The Sharon government, the last thing it wants to do is be building security barriers because it doesn't want any borders to be running along anything like the line that this fence is running along. It's being built to stop the bombers. So I'm very sorry, really, that ordinary people on the Palestinian side are going to suffer as a consequence of this barrier in areas where they are going to suffer. And I say again, the solution to all of this is stop the bombers and have a leadership that wants to stop the bombers and a public that tries to root out the bombers, because then we can settle down to peace talks and actually erect a mutually acceptable border along lines that both mainstream leaderships accept.
My guest is David Horovitz. He's the editor and a columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Horovitz. He's the editor and a columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. There is a peace plan that was written up by a group of Palestinians and Israelis in an unofficial capacity. These are not government representatives. Some of them have worked on previous peace agreements. Some of them have not. But this is meant to be a model, something that the official peace negotiators can look at and say, maybe we can borrow from this. What do you think are like the main couple of points of this peace plan, and what do you think of the peace plan? Do you think that this is something that could in fact be a model?
Well, I think that the imperative, the motivation for the negotiators to do this, part of it stems from the absence of proactive diplomatic policies by the Israeli government. As I think I've made clear, I certainly see terrorism as the root cause of the collapse, but I also think Israel has an absolute self-interest in encouraging Palestinian moderation and needs to signal that with the same resoluteness that it says we will fight terrorism as best as we can, that we seek peace as passionately as we can. And it needs to make clear that if the terrorism were to stop, Israel would be rushing back to the peace table. And I think that message perhaps is not sent strongly enough by this government. And one of the reasons why I think these Geneva Accords have resonated as they have quite widely in Israel is because I think a lot of Israelis want to get the message across that they want to make peace and want to know whether there's anyone on the other side. There are elements of this accord that are problematic for most Israelis. For example, unlike at Camp David 3 years ago when the former prime minister, the prime minister at the time, Ehud Barak, said no to Palestinian demands for full Palestinian sovereignty at the Temple Mount, the holiest place in Judaism and site of the third holiest shrine in Islam, the Geneva Accords do award Palestinian sovereignty on the Temple Mount. I think most Israelis will be unhappy about that, to put it mildly. It seems that there is something of a breakthrough on the refugee issue, which is encouraging. It may be that in these model accords, the Palestinians are signalling a readiness to find a viable solution for the issue of Palestinian refugees that doesn't demographically overwhelm Jewish Israel. If that's the case, that's positive. It is claimed by the negotiators that these accords represent the first official Palestinian recognition or formal Palestinian recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. Now, reading the text, I don't think it quite says that. I think the Palestinian negotiators here are saying the Jews have a right to statehood. They don't say that Israel should be has the right to exist as a Jewish state. Now, if it sounds like I'm quibbling, these kinds of nuances are very, very important. The bottom line, though, is that this is a model accord. It's not binding on the Palestinian leadership. And I think there's a problem here in that you have an Israeli self-appointed negotiating team that is, albeit in a model accord, making concessions that most Israelis, at the moment at least, wouldn't agree to. And I fear that might make it harder for a legitimate Israeli government to make peace on better terms for Israel. I think you're going to have a Palestinian leadership that's going to say, well, in the Geneva Accords, you agreed to, and we want at least that, or we want better than that. And if that's the result, then of course it will have been the opposite of what these negotiators wanted. They may actually have made it harder for Israel to reach a viable agreement.
In the Geneva Accords, the right of return is dealt with. And what the Geneva Accord says is that Palestinians should have the right to move to the new Palestinian state, but they would not have the right to return to land that they once had within Israel. Raja Shahadeh, who I spoke with earlier, said that he's a Palestinian human rights lawyer. He said that plan would fall short for him. He thinks that there should be some kind of right of return, and not literally the right of all Palestinians to return, but the right of some to return to Israel, and then some kind of ratio for compensation for those who would have liked to return but cannot, or that wouldn't be allowed to. What would your reaction to that kind of ratio for compensation be?
Well, first of all, the notion of compensation, if he means financial compensation, I think is something that most Israelis would be very amenable to endorsing, the notion that people should be compensated financially. The notion of an unlimited number of Palestinians being given the option to come and live in Israel is something that most Israelis would reject, because they think it would be used to overwhelm Israel by weight of numbers. Israel has 6.5 million people, 5 and a bit million Jews, 1 and a bit million Arabs, and the maximalist demand for a right of return is for 4 million plus Palestinians, and that, for Israelis who do the basic math, is tantamount to a call for Israel's destruction. So any kind of quote-unquote right that left open the possibility of millions of Palestinians coming into Israel will never be accepted by most Israelis or by an Israeli government. And I think most Israelis are probably so concerned about that issue and so bitter about Arafat's position on that issue that they would resist really even a much more limited entry of Palestinians into Israel. As far as most Israelis are concerned, Israel absorbed huge numbers of Jewish refugees from around the Middle East and North Africa and built a vibrant state on its part of mandatory Palestine. And the Palestinian leadership and those who spoke for it, rather than doing the same, rather than facing up to a division of territory that neither side was particularly happy about, and building their own independent country and absorbing their own refugees, instead tried to destroy Israel, and has relentlessly tried to destroy Israel ever since. And therefore, in Israel, there is a very, very, very wide misgiving about any kind of refugee, quote-unquote, right of return.
What about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank? This is always a sticking point in negotiations. And the question is, should Israel give up all of its settlements? Should it give up some of its settlements? How should those settlements be protected if they remain? Where do you think popular opinion is on that now?
Israeli popular opinion has always been and remains incredibly divided about the settlement issue. There are people who support the entire enterprise. There are people who believe that there should be limited settlement around Jerusalem and in areas where Israel is at its narrowest. There are parts of Israel where the country's 9 miles wide. And in those areas, perhaps some settlement adjoining what is today sovereign Israel would be vital in the conception of many Israelis. And there are many Israelis who oppose the whole settlement enterprise in total. It seems to me that Israel has failed itself in not trying to formulate a blueprint, because, again, there is a consensus in Israel on the need for a territorial accommodation with the Palestinians. We don't think we can continue to maintain Israel as an overwhelmingly Jewish state and as a democracy unless we can find an accommodation with the Palestinians, and that by definition means relinquishing large parts of the West Bank, and settlements, if they're all over the West Bank, become a hugely complicating factor in any such agreement.
You've said that the way out of the situation that the Middle East is in, and the way out of the new restrictions on the Palestinians, is to stop the Palestinian bombings, the suicide bombings. Do you think that there's something that the Israeli government could alter in its political or military approach that would encourage Palestinians to stop the suicide bombings?
Look, I think that there are things that Israel can do to try and reach out to ordinary Palestinians over the heads of their leadership and tell them that we are waiting to embrace you at the peace table. We want to make peace. Most Israelis favor territorial separation from the Palestinians. I think the things that Israel can do are marginal, however. We can't fix this by ourselves. We have to have a leadership on the other side. I don't think most Israelis expect the Palestinian leadership to stop all acts of terrorism, but we are the absolute opposite of that situation. We have a Palestinian leadership whose most prominent public figure, Mr. Arafat, is actually encouraging people to carry out attacks. And you know, there are things that Israel can do to give a chance for moderation, but the key overwhelming responsibility and facility for changing things lies with the Palestinian leaders who the Palestinian public believe in and identify with, and they have to offer a different tone.
Is there a controversy in Israel over the morality of using helicopter gunships to go after militants and potential suicide bombers within the West Bank in civilian areas?
Look, there is dismay in Israel when, as a consequence of one or other of those attacks, civilians are killed. There was a case in Gaza, I think it was last year, when the Hamas commander in Gaza, Salah Shehadeh, was killed in one such attack. But 15, I think, Palestinians, innocent Palestinians, many of them children, were killed as well. And there was all hell to pay in terms of the Israeli internal debate and a great deal of condemnation within Israel. One of the factors that has so alienated moderate Israelis in terms of the Palestinian leadership is the very fact that we are being blown up everywhere. Because if the Palestinian goal was what they want you, me, and the rest of the world to believe, which is they want to liberate the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, then the last thing that they should be doing is attacking West Jerusalem and Haifa and Tel Aviv. Because what they're doing is they're telling Israelis who, and many of whom may not be interested in holding on to those areas, many of whom would be very ready to relinquish those areas, they're telling them that that's not enough. It doesn't matter if you give up the West Bank and Gaza. We want it all. We're terrorizing all of Israel. And I think we assume, because it didn't happen, that Israel would survive 3 years of horrific terrorist onslaught. But I think the assumption may have been by those who fostered this campaign that they would destroy Israel. I mean, how would America have dealt with the proportional equivalent to 100-plus suicide bombings in our tiny country? I don't even know how sky-high a number that would mean in sort of equivalent terms for America. How would America have dealt with 100 suicide bombings, which is what we've had, with nowhere being off limits? What would people have demanded, and how would they have changed their actions, and would they have sought to flee to safer climes? So I think there was a very deliberate campaign launched here to terrorize all of Israel. And if Israelis believed this was only about the disputed territory, they'd probably be much less bitter and much less disillusioned about the Palestinian leadership. They believe, because they think that's what the bombers are telling us in bloody red letters day after day, that this is a campaign to terrorize all of Israel.
David Horovitz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Horovitz is the editor of the Israeli news magazine The Jerusalem Report and author of the forthcoming book Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews tonight's season premiere of 24. This is Fresh Air. The Fox network waited until after it broadcast the World Series to roll out most of its new and returning shows, including tonight's third season premiere of the action thriller series 24. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Last season on 24, Jack Bauer, the government anti-terrorist agent played by Kiefer Sutherland, died, but only for a few minutes. He also saved the day again. And the days on this show are 24 hours long, broadcast in as many episodes in real and really exciting time. For Jack, the season ended with a major surprise. President Palmer, played by Dennis Haysbert, was shaking hands at an impromptu rally when a terrorist agent laced the president's hand with some toxic substance. Palmer collapsed immediately, even as Jack, who had undergone severe torture, was being carted away in an ambulance. In other words, 24 had painted itself into one incredibly tight corner. So how does the show begin its third season tonight? Basically, by breaking through a wall in that corner and setting up shop in a completely different location. I'm not giving much away because we learn this in the first minute of the first hour of this new 24 day. Instead of picking up the story after a summer had elapsed, as we did after season one, or immediately after last season's cliffhanger, tonight's season opener jumps ahead 3 years. This isn't an unprecedented move. Over on ABC, Alias began its third season by jumping ahead 2 years. But it's really smart, because it allows the mysteries to be buried in the past, as well as laying an ambush straight ahead. Fans of this show are very dedicated. They have to be, because 24, in its serialized form, isn't the sort of show you can skip many episodes of. So I'm not ruining any surprises by laying out the following very basic information. Jack is back, and so is the president, who survived his poison attack. Tony and Michelle still work closely with Jack, and each other, at the counter-terrorist unit. But Jack has a new young partner now, Chase Edmonds, played by James Badge Dale. And in the show's best new move, Jack also has another new colleague, his daughter Kim, played by Elijah Cuthbert. Kim, in the past 2 seasons, has been the most accident-prone woman on TV, and her attack by cougars last year was dangerously close to parody. But now, with a serious job at CTU, a more mature haircut, and a decent boyfriend for a change, Daddy's little girl goes through this year's first 2 episodes without being in any mortal danger at all. For 24, this is a first. Oh, and her new boyfriend? We learn his identity right away, but Jack takes a little longer to find out that Kim's lover is Jack's partner. This makes the scenes between Jack and Chase, played very well by Sutherland and Dale, supercharged even when they're not in mortal danger.
I'm sorry if you think I'm not good enough for your daughter. Okay, but I can't help the way I feel. Chase, why do you think I put Kim at CTU? Behind a desk working a computer. So I could keep an eye on her, make sure she's safe. Not so she could start dating some field agent.
Safe? You know, you're talking about her like she's 12 years old. She's a grown woman.
Damn it, Chase, you've seen what this job can do to you. You've seen what it's done to me. It's ruined every relationship I've ever had.
That's you, Jack.
No! No, it's the job.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? What the hell do you know? My wife died because of this job. And I almost lost Kim, too. I'm not gonna let that happen again. I will do everything I have to protect her. Do you understand me? Everything. Damn it, Chase. You cannot have a normal life and do this job at the same time.
So you're saying I shouldn't have a relationship with anyone?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And especially with my daughter.
The rest of the show, the villain, the terrorist threat, the other new characters, I'll let you discover for yourself. And you should, because 24 maintains its high standards and is one of the best and most satisfying shows on TV right now. Tonight's season premiere, like last year's, is shown without commercial interruption. On any other show, that would be terrific news. But on 24, where the action is so furious and the atmosphere is so tense, you almost welcome the breaks.
David Bianculli reviews TV for Fresh Air and the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Knopf, publisher of Our Lady of the Forest, the new novel by David Gutterson, author of Snow Falling on Cedars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Bridges, the star of The Last Picture Show, The Fisher King, Tucker, The Big Lebowski, and Seabiscuit, has a new collection of photographs taken on the sets of his movies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.